For the first time in modern history, a member of the royal family has been arrested. For the first time since the 1980s, the crucial oil choke point of the Strait of Hormuz has been closed. And both China and the US are close to grabbing different sea gates. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew, was arrested yesterday on suspicion of misconduct in public office. This is the biggest, most dramatic fallout from the Epstein files. And to have the king's brother arrested for kind of selling out his country to a known child sex trafficker, and that's got to be one of the most humiliating moments in the royal family's long history. Now, the police didn't say much more than that in terms of what they were arresting him for, but we can look at what information has come out to get a good idea. There's a couple of different charges or different accusations against him that could come under the umbrella of misconduct in a public office. He was accused of asking his official police bodyguard to dig up dirt on a woman that was accusing him of rape, the implication being he was trying to discredit her. He was also accused of passing on confidential information to Jeffrey Epstein, information that Jeffrey Epstein as a financier and an investor could potentially make billions of dollars on. So he was, Prince Andrew was Britain's trade envoy for a while. There was one time where he went on a trade mission to China and then passed on a confidential report after that to Jeffrey Epstein. You know, this could have details about opportunities in China that British companies are pursuing, things the British government is doing to subsidize or encourage that. One of the most damning, I think, was after the 2008 financial crisis and the government was getting ready to bail out the Royal Bank of Scotland, he was passing on information to Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, those are kind of things that, this is where George Soros made huge amounts of his money in things like betting on the weakness of the pound in the early 1990s. And the picture that we're getting here potentially is Prince Andrew selling out his country, Prince Andrew helping Jeffrey Epstein with insider information, and then getting a kickback, getting kind of quid pro quo with access to young girls or young ladies. I don't think there's any accusation so far against Prince Andrew potentially of paedophilia, but certainly there are damaging accusations with him and girls supplied by Jeffrey Epstein. The British press has rightly been scathing about this. The politician and author Norman Baker had an article in the Daily Mail earlier this week where he wrote, "Treason is a strong word, but how else would you describe the actions of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor?" He wrote in there, "It seems that British national interest counted for little when weighed against Andrew's wish to stay cozy with his friend Jeffrey Epstein and his lucrative connections in the world of finance." He also wrote, the closer to the center of Andrew we get, the more putrid the stench. And now comes compelling evidence he's been selling out his own country. It is a big moment. Stephen Glover, he had another article in the Daily Mail. "No member of that family, the royal family, since Edward VIII, who gave up the throne in 1938 and later hobnobbed and colluded with Nazis, has done the monarchy more harm than Mountbatten Windsor." And one thing I think that's crucial to understand about this is not the end of the story. If anything, this is just the beginning of something that's going to continue to get worse and worse and worse for the royal family. And another article in the Daily Mail today by Richard Kay, he wrote, "It's now quite likely that however long or short the king's reign will be remembered for one thing and one thing only, Andrew and how he dealt with him." He wrote in there, "Yesterday's arrest is not the end of the issue, but rather the beginning." And he's right. Like, now the police have arrested him, they've gone, they've searched his home, they've got all of these documents. What's going to come out further? Right now, it seems like they're investigating misconduct in a public office, but they'll get their hands on more things if there's accusations. There's some evidence that Prince Andrew was involved in sex trafficking. Could we see charges on there added on? There's a lot of suspicion around his connections to Middle Eastern royals and other wealthy financiers. So we could see this widening into more cases of financial corruption. People are asking, well, actually, the lifestyle that Prince Andrew has been living for years seems to be much, much more, to require a whole lot more money than he would have had available to him on the money that he was getting from the king, from the taxpayer, from his Royal Navy pension. And I think we could be looking at ongoing scandals now again and again and again. More and more disgraces. There's fresh accusations, I think just even today, about his links to Iceland and bailouts happening in the 2008 financial crisis in Iceland, and him tipping off insider information to Icelandic financial officials. And then you've got just how the process of the court case could play out. Going back to that Richard Kay article in the Daily Mail, he says that should Andrew be charged after his arrest, and his arrest already placed us in uncharted territory, the legal terrain would be treacherous in ways rarely discussed publicly. It would lead to a court case and would be a global sensation. Just imagine the brother of Britain's sovereign on trial in one of His Majesty's courts, where judges and magistrates sit beneath the royal coat of arms. Verdicts of guilty or not guilty could be equally damaging to the monarchy. Others have pointed out that in Britain, once somebody is charged with a crime, the newspapers are supposed to stop talking about it. And in fact, people have been prosecuted for tweeting about these kind of things. So you could have the situation where once he's charged, if he is, the British media cannot say anything. The American media and other overseas media will be completely free to talk about the case. And then those that share American news links on Twitter, if they're based in Britain, they could find themselves arrested. And that's a pretty incendiary situation. And I think Britain's whole attitude to reporting on jury trials and trials that are underway is completely unsustainable in the modern world. But this could be one of the things that explodes that. And you've got a lot of potential now for stories about censorship. What's that going to do for the royal family's reputation if you start having police arresting people for sharing news articles about Prince Andrew? Richard Kay points out another potentially explosive situation where Andrew Mountbatten Windsor could say, he could potentially call the king as a witness. He says that if he were to claim that he'd kept the king informed of any part of his conduct, the implications for the constitution would be extraordinary. As monarch, Charles cannot testify or be a witness in his own courts. And he points back to a trial in 2002 that collapsed on exactly that. There was a butler who said that he informed the queen on aspects of what he was charged with, and the courts just couldn't find a way to deal with that. The Queen couldn't be called as a witness. The trial collapsed. Could that well happen? The article concludes, his fall may now be complete. The question is whether he brings down the House of Windsor with him. This is the beginning of the disaster, and there are a lot of ways this could get worse and worse and worse. And this is happening on a backdrop around a country losing interest with the royal family. There's the British Social Attitude Survey. It's been asking every year, is the monarchy important to the UK? The first time it asked that in 1983, 81% said, yes, the monarchy is important to the UK. September, 51%. I'm sure if they asked that question now, it would probably be significantly lower. This is probably the tipping point where you have most people in Britain say, no, the monarchy is not important. It's not significant to us. I think in many ways, the thing that has kept the monarchy from being under pressure within the UK in recent years hasn't been that people love it. Instead, it's just been more apathy, that getting rid of it would be too much work. And it would absolutely be a lot of work to unpick. It's the Crown Court, the Crown Prosecution Service, His Majesty's government, His Majesty's loyal opposition, the Royal Air Force, trying to separate all of that and get rid of it would be a massive effort and require a huge amount of legal work and rewriting of even the basic constitutional elements of how the government is run. So I think you've reached the position where we could, maybe if we were to design something from scratch, we wouldn't have the monarchy, but it's too much work to get rid of it. But something like this with Prince Andrew, you could definitely see that causing a lot of people to say, maybe it is worth doing that. And then what are the implications for the Commonwealth? We are already seeing more and more Commonwealth nations turn their back on the royal family. and on the British Commonwealth and on those ties. What are they going to do in the latest part of these revelations? You know, rather than being something that united a Commonwealth and helped provide a common vision and something to aspire to, well, now the Royal Britain's royal family could be seen very reasonably as a liability. Something that is corrupt and even seedy. Then they want to stay well away from. So this isn't a news story that ends today or ends this week. And I think time could well prove this to be the most significant crisis for the royal family in my lifetime. And in reading about this and working on this, I went back to our cover article from the September 2017 Trumpet print edition by Mr. Gerald Flurry, The Fall of the British Royal Family. And it's such a prophetic article. I mean, it's based on Bible prophecy. It's based on the Word of God. And I think if you want proof of that, just read the article and look at what has happened today. I mean, that is from a mind of under the inspiration of a God that knows what is going on behind closed doors, knows what wasn't in public domain in 2017, say, or what we didn't know about, knows how this is going to play out. I mean, in there, Mr. Flurry wrote, Britain has become an immoral cesspool and the royal family is going right along with it. And that cesspool looks a whole lot more disgusting now. In that article, he called out Prince Charles. He talked about, well, then Prince Charles, now King Charles. He said that he is married to the woman he left his wife for. You know, talking about that marriage, he said, did they have a God-playing relationship? The whole public knows it was in the lowest parts of the gutter. And so even King Charles, okay, he looks much better compared to Prince Andrew now, or Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. I guess he's no longer a prince. But even his family life was a horrible example to the nation. But what stood out most to me in looking at that article is Mr. Flurry probably spends most of the article talking about family and the royal family's bad example when it comes to family and how catastrophic that is for the nation. Family is the most sacred of all institutions, he writes. Strong families are the backbone of a nation. When families fall apart, nations fall. And what do we have now? We have the brother of the king selling out his own country in exchange for perverted favors from Jeffrey Epstein, or taking advantage of those favors and being blackmailed. Or, I mean, we don't know all the details, but it's pretty disgusting. That article forecasts that the rapid decline that we could already see in 2017 in that royal family would get much worse. That's happened. That's where we are today. And the reason why we focus on this is God has a lot to say about a royal family in his word. We can look at 2 Samuel chapter 7 and look at some world news in the light of Bible prophecy. God has a lot to say about a royal family here. He's talking to David. And he tells David, when your days be fulfilled and you shall sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, which shall proceed out of your bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And he will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. God told David that he would establish his kingdom forever, that it would last forever. Well, if we believe the Bible, where is that? And yes, Jesus Christ will sit on that throne, and Luke 1:35 confirms that. But that promise wasn't fulfilled at Jesus Christ's first coming. I mean, first of all, Judah goes into captivity around 600 BC. So, well, where's the throne preserved during those 600 years between that captivity and Jesus Christ? If it's going to exist forever and for all generations, as it says there elsewhere, well, where was it for those 600 years? So it's not enough to spiritualize this away and say, well, it was fulfilled at Jesus Christ's first coming. No, I mean, Jesus Christ said he was born to be a king. He is going to sit on that throne at his second coming. And so that throne is going to exist from David right on down to Jesus Christ's second coming. It has to be here today. And that's what Herbert W. Armstrong shows in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That throne was preserved in Ireland and then in the British Isles, in the royal family ruling in London. And it continued on down from David through the centuries. And notice verse 14, it says, I will be his father and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chastise him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. And it's a family throne. There's a vision in family that is intimately tied with that throne. In his 2017 article, Mr. Flurry writes, marriage and family are God-plane relationships that prepare us to enter our marriage with Jesus Christ and our place in the God in the family of God. It is man's only hope. And he's talking about some of the homosexuality and perversions that Britain has been getting into and the royal family has even been encouraging. And he says, you cannot understand the magnitude of this sin unless you understand God's master plan for family. And God as a family is about bringing mankind into the God family as sons of God. And the throne plays a major part in that. There's a personal relationship that God talks about with that throne. And then look at what the royal family has been getting into. Look at the family values and family life that's been going on in Britain. And so in that article, Mr. Flurry says, God is already changing the way that he deals with the royal family, which explains why 2017 has been so tragic by far. You know, there's an important change, and Mr. Flurry wrote about that in his free book, The New Throne of David, which we would love to send you. Just some profound revelation if you've not received that or if you've not read that. And you see why God made the change when you see what is going on with that throne in Britain. I mean, Jesus Christ's return is imminent. We're getting really close to that time. He's about to come and sit on that throne. Is that throne going to come through people like King Charles and then Prince Andrew and then on to Jesus Christ? You know, is God going to receive that throne from those that have it currently and all of those perversions? I mean, Britain doesn't even want to be associated with that throne anymore from a lot of people because of what Prince Andrew and others have been getting into. I mean, what does God think about that? And so he's been making a change in how he deals with that throne, and that New Throne of David booklet explains that. And you see the events of this week, and so much of that booklet is you see that being prophetic. You see why God had to do that. And I think it really brings that book to life. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you've not read anything, maybe start with the United States and Britain and Prophecy that proves to you why that throne was in Britain. And then the New Throne of David that shows you how God is changing what he's doing with that throne and how he is getting ready for the return of Jesus Christ to come and sit on that throne. But that's a big part of the reason why we watch this critical news story from the UK. There's also been a lot of important news coming out of Europe this week, and we covered a good chunk of that on our Wednesday show with Joshua Michels, where we sat down and analyzed some of the speeches from the Munich Security Conference. It was a pretty big, I mean, the Munich Security Conference, it's always a good state of the union. Like, how is the European military complex getting on? What is Europe's relationship to America? It's some good insight into that. And really, we saw a huge amount of division there, more from Europe this time than from Donald Trump. And we saw Friedrich Merz basically get up and kind of try to paint Donald Trump as the new Hitler. And so we talked about that. We talked about how much effort was going on during that conference and with the media to really promote Germany's militarization. And throughout the rest of the week, we've seen some more headlines along those lines. One of those came on Tuesday when Politico had an article citing German insiders talking about changes that Germany wants to make to its secret service, its Federal Intelligence Service. It's been very tightly contained or controlled. There's been more restrictions on Germany's secret service than, say, on the American, on the British. because of what Germany, and in particular the German secret services, did during World War II. But now they're looking at changing that because they're saying, well, the way that it is right now and the fact that we can't do certain things that other countries have, that makes us reliant on Donald Trump and on the Americans. And so we need to get rid of that. And we need to get rid of restrictions that prevent us from acting offensively or from spying on a whole lot of people. And what I thought was fascinating is the Politico article itself acknowledged that the Germany's intelligence service was all founded by former Nazis and set up by former Nazis, but they just mentioned that in passing and they move on, and they weren't sounding the alarm at setting this organization loose. But that's a dangerous trend if you know the history of that organization. I mean, just a decade or two ago, they were covering up a lot of their links to the Nazis, and they were crucial in even things like the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, preventing Nazis being rounded up and punished. So very disturbing to see that organization being empowered in that fashion. That's an important part of the rise of German militarism to keep watching. And again, you can look back on Wednesday's show for more about that. We also had Germany getting a bit annoyed at France for not doing more to boost its military spending. They're very focused on getting more military capabilities from Europe, and they were telling France, you're not pulling your weight. There was a fascinating article this week as well in the American Conservative. It's deeply ironic that it's from the American Conservative, but it was by a former Alternative for Deutschland member of parliament, and he's now still got a pretty senior position in the Bundestag. And what I think is important about who wrote it is the AfD hasn't really figured out how to deal with Europe and what their pan-European policy is, because the AfD began just over 10 years ago as kind of a pretty nerdy party by a bunch of economists that was generally Eurosceptic, and they didn't want German money being used to bail out Greece, and a large part of that party was actually kind of like the idea of Germany quitting the European Union. Now, the landscape and the AfD has changed a lot since that time, but there's some Euroscepticism in its DNA. But you're living in a Europe now where all these different countries have their own versions of the Alternative for Deutschland, have their own versions of these fringe right parties. And so they want to work together and push a united vision in Brussels. And well, how do they do that when some of this party's background is about trying to get Germany out of the EU? And they've never really, I don't think, come up with a coherent, logical, this is what we want from the EU. And that's what this article by Dr. Anton Friesen sets out. For the first time, the AfD is starting to figure out this is what we want from Europe. And what they want from Europe, from this, by some measures, most popular party in Germany, and this, with some leaders, neo-Nazi party in Germany, what they want is a new Holy Roman Empire. And the article was all about how, well, Europe's not really working right now. What we need is empire. Europe is built on three metaphorical hills, namely Calvary, or Christianity, the Capitoline Hill, Roman law, and the Acropolis, Greek philosophy. One concept that brings unity to this diversity is the European idea of empire. It says the Holy Roman Empire and the Habsburg monarchies, for all their shortcomings, coped with internal diversity for centuries under the rule of the empire, of the emperor. And that very quickly glosses over shortcomings and copes with internal diversity. I mean, this is an empire that crushed dissent. This is an empire, the Spanish Inquisition. That was under the Spanish Habsburgs. The 30 Years' War grew out of attempts from the Holy Roman Empire to crush Protestant dissent and to deal with diversity. And it was, in percentage terms, I think probably still to this day, the most destructive war Europe has ever seen. More destructive than World War I and World War II, if you're looking at the percentage of Europe's population. There were German principalities under the Holy Roman Empire that lost half of their population during that battle, that conflict. And he glosses over that in about five words. You know, that's what we need to get back to, the Holy Roman Empire. And he said, well, we need to have a president who would be, quote, rather like the Holy Roman Emperor. And he says, well, that's more of a mediator job, but we need one president rather than five. I mean, look at what they're talking about. This is what Herbert W. Armstrong forecast for years. And this, just like that story with Prince Andrew, this is Bible prophecy come to life. And as I said, this is something that has legs. This is something where the AFD now have a more coherent policy on what to do with Europe. And watch for this to be discussed and to continue to become a driving theme for what Germany wants from Europe. And then he did say, well, we could have a Europe that steps back in some areas. You know, maybe they don't regulate lawnmowers quite as much and set labor policy. And we leave some of that to the different European member states. But instead, we work on having an army. And he talked about the need for more military might and more military unity. So, you know, we focus on some of those areas and cut back on some others, and that appeases some of the Eurosceptic elements. Like I said, it's going to be an influential article, and it's talking about exactly what the Bible forecasts. And you can have more on that Bible forecast in the Holy Roman Empire in prophecy. Well, one final story I wanted to mention quickly from the UK, where apparently, now that with Donald Trump preparing to bomb Iran, Britain has said not using our bases. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has said that, well, bombing Iran could violate international law, and so we're not going to let you use our bases to do this. And Starmer was a human rights lawyer before he became Prime Minister. And I think this punctilious approach to international law is very dangerous. It's pretty bonkers, really. I mean, international law, there's no single world government. So international law is this very fragile, malleable thing. It doesn't stop aggressors. There's no real court system to give authoritative rulings. You do have some courts, you know, in The Hague and the Netherlands that can rule on some things, but there's no unified system. They have limited jurisdiction. They can be ignored by any country that they want. And an example of this is, well, the UK signed the Kellogg-Brand Pact in 1928, which outlaws war under all circumstances. You're not allowed war. So are Neville Chamberlain and Winston Churchill war criminals? I mean, the Keir Starmers of 1938 and 1939, they wouldn't have just surrendered to Adolf Hitler in Munich. They would have said in September 1939, no, we can't declare war on Germany. I know they invaded Poland, but well, we might violate international law if we declare war on Hitler now. It's an insane policy. And in trying to ensure that everything Britain does adheres really strictly to international law, he's paralyzing the nation. He's dividing Britain from one of our most important allies. You know, he's basically handing the Chagos Islands and the Diego Garcia military base and the Indian Ocean to China because of some Chinese Communist Party affiliated judge and how she reads some piece of legislation or some piece of international treaty that Britain specifically said, no, this doesn't apply to us. And Hosea 7 and verse 11 talks about modern Britain as a silly dove. And that's exactly what you see with this ruling on display. And again, our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, talks about that in more detail. But talking of Iran, talking of Donald Trump preparing to attack Iran, this has been a major week of potential buildup. We saw more threats from Donald Trump. We've seen more pushback from Iran. We've seen military drills in the Strait of Hormuz. We've seen Iran close the straits for the first time since the 1980s. So to give us the latest on what is going on here, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, 10 days, or really 9 days now, is the limit Iran has to reach a nuclear deal with the U.S. or face an attack. That's what President Trump said yesterday. America has been more or less encircling Iran with about as many assets, military assets, as it possibly could. Some analysts have been saying that this is the greatest concentration of U.S. air power and maybe military power in general in the Middle East since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. There's at least two aircraft carriers in the vicinity, including the USS Gerald R. Ford, considered to be America's most powerful warship period. And President Trump, this was a few weeks ago, but he publicly toyed with the idea of regime change. So it looks like Iran may very well face a military attack, or at least the U.S. wants to give that impression. As I mentioned, this is in the context of the nuclear negotiations that this week happened in Switzerland between Iran and the U.S. There has reportedly been some progress in creating a framework, and Iran has offered some concessions it hadn't offered before. But in general, everything the U.S. is asking, no to enrichment, destruction of its nuclear infrastructure, destruction of its ballistic missile program, Iran has said, no, 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 we're not doing that. And as you alluded to, not only are they saying no to all these demands, but they are also doing some saber-rattling of their own. On Tuesday, Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway that connects the Persian Gulf with the rest of the world's oceans. This is the first time that Iran had done so since the 1980s, in the middle of the Iran-Iraq War, when you had two Gulf powers fighting each other. This was only temporary, but it was for a naval exercise that featured live fire. So certainly tensions are ratcheting up in the Middle East, and neither side seems ready or willing to back down.
Now, I saw this morning Donald Trump said that he's got, that Iran's got 10 to 15 days to respond. And in some ways, this is looking like the parent that says, you do that again, and you're in big trouble, mister. And he does it again. And then the parent says, well, you do that again, and you're in big trouble. And he does it again. And it's like, well, you better not do that again, because if you do, then I'll do that. Is that kind of, like, how likely is it that Donald Trump is going to actually respond? I mean, just like the parent, Donald Trump does snap and respond sometimes. So what do you think is going on here?
Well, I'll say this much. If you go back to June, when we're having these very similar tensions, President Trump said he would make a decision on striking Iran within 2 weeks. And it was only within a few days when he actually made the strike. I guess a few days is within 2 weeks. But we've been down this before. And if Trump was going to strike Iran, he would say the 10 to 15 days deadline. But as you mentioned, there's been plenty of other instances in other theaters, especially like, say, the Ukrainian war. He promised to solve that within 24 hours of being elected. It's been well over a year now, and he keeps threatening all these big sanctions. Putin's gone crazy. We're going to go after him, and nothing ever actually pans out from that, which certainly plays into the president's negotiationable ability, I guess you could say, because nobody really knows what he's going to do. And that gives him a lot of leverage just in how unpredictable he can make the circumstances.
So we're looking at this in light of Bible prophecy. What does that tell us about how this will play out?
Prophecy, of course, is in Daniel 11, verse 40, which speaks of an end-time clash between a king of the south and a king of the north. We can put a link into our show notes of Mr. Fleury's book, The King of the South, which elaborates how this prophecy is speaking of Iran and its radical Islamist allies fulfilling the role of the King of the South, and Catholic Europe, led by Germany, as you were recently talking about, fulfilling the role of the King of the North, and how Iran and its aggressive Islamist worldview, Iran is the one to start this conflict. It pushes Europe, it provokes Europe. But the big, I think I've covered this on this program before, the big elephant in the room is that America is not mentioned in this prophecy. This is what Mr. Fleury writes in The King of the South, quote, "The blatantly bold and aggressive foreign policy of Iran must lead to war. It will either conquer or be conquered. Bible prophecy makes it clear that Iran will be conquered." Okay. Sounds like, okay, Iran's aggressive, it's bold, that's true right now. America is saying that it wants to do something about that. That looks like it's right in line, but look what Mr. Fleury says further down. "Think seriously about the fact that this will not occur at the hands of America or Britain. These nations aren't even involved in this prophesied war. That is because they are going to fall into social and economic ruin before this prophecy is even fulfilled. The time when Britain and America were superpowers or kings is history. End quote. So Mr. Fleury is not anticipating America having anything to do with neutering Iran or changing its direction or cutting off the head of the snake, as the Israelis say, of radical Islamist terrorism. We don't know exactly what President Trump is going to do, but I think there are quite a few signs that this is not going to bring about successful regime change. You'll think about, for example, Venezuela. When President Trump took Nicolas Maduro, the president there, to face drug trafficking charges, but he left his vice president and all the other apparatus in Venezuela in place. It's the same government, and okay, maybe the new leadership has softened its tone, tried to flatter Trump like everybody else in the international community, but they're still arresting people, they still have their hold on power. Nothing really has changed fundamentally. And as I mentioned, Iran is digging in its heels. It was humiliated last year in June. You would think that they realize they have nothing left to lose. Let's cut some kind of a deal. Their actions sound like they know something everybody else doesn't, that they know their situation isn't as bad as maybe it looks on the surface, that either they have plenty of cards to play or that their belief in their system and they're willing to go down choking in their own blood is so great that no amount of saber-rattling from Washington is going to change this. And I think, if I may tie this in, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, I do not think that was a warning to the United States. I think that was a warning to Saudi Arabia and Qatar and all these other Gulf states that are really close with President Trump, that rely on freedom of transport to keep their economies afloat. They know, Iran knows that a lot of these countries have President Trump's ear, especially Qatar, that if they can influence these smaller countries to say something, that they'll back off. Iran also keeps making statements that this is going to drag the United States into another forever war with the Middle East, and they've been saying that for a while, but if President Trump wants to do something serious, it's hard to see how he could do anything without doing that. And Iran knows his base, the Tucker Carlson crowd, have been pressuring him not to do that. And so I think Iran knows that if they prod these pressure points enough, Trump will cave in. And again, we'll see exactly how this all plays out within the next few days, but Iran looks pretty confident that it's going to survive this crisis and come out of it and keep doing what it's doing. And that they're being able to be as bold and aggressive as they are suggests that this is not going to end well for the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's another aspect of this prophecy that leaps off the page, where Daniel 11 and verse 40 talks about the king of the south pushing at the king of the north. Like, it's a bold, aggressive action, which the king of the north, it's not the United States. And Mr. Fleury shows that in the King of the South booklet. This is about them pushing at Europe. So, you know, that's not what happened here. But you see Iran's pushy nature. I mean, that is pretty bold and gutsy and aggressive to have the world's number one superpower breathing down your neck, threatening fire and fury. And they're just like, well, I'm just going to close one of the most important choke points as far as oil is concerned. And this is about 20 to 30% of the world's total seaborne oil travels through the Strait of Hormuz. 20 million barrels per day. And it's just, yep, we're going to close it and we're going to hold live fire military exercises. And they're not scared at all. And it's you see how it's going to lead to, they'll take that same approach to Europe as well. And they and a whole lot of the rest of the world will be flabbergasted at the really aggressive response that they get from that. They think that they'll be able to keep pushing Europe around the way that they can get away with pushing even someone like Donald Trump around. And you wrote earlier, you know, that potentially you could still see some changes here. You know, maybe you could have some kind of European Napoleon come on the scene, as even one Iranian writer was writing. Sorry, an Iranian Napoleon come on the scene. Like, you could see there's still plenty of scope within Bible prophecy for, you know, Venezuela style operation, something that's where Iran is still aggressive, but maybe goes in a bit of a different direction or has some changes to its government. But it's going to keep being pushy and aggressive like that. And we really saw that this week. So that's another news story that you just see, you know, things leaping off the pages of your Bible from this week. You see so much of that all around the world. And again, our book, The King of the South, has more on that. But what more do you have for us, Mihailo, from the Middle East?
It's two significant stories. The U.S. has confirmed it is withdrawing all of its approximately 1,000 soldiers from Syria. So once this is all said and done, America will no longer have a military presence in Syria. These soldiers, they were sent in to fight ISIS. They've lasted throughout the civil war years, the Assad years. They were in here since the successful Syrian revolution this whole time. But the indication is that President Trump feels the new government in Syria, who is led by a former Al-Qaeda operative whose new army is based off of international jihadists coming to Syria to spread the Al-Qaeda vision. President Trump thinks they are a reliable partner for peace, that America doesn't want anything to do with that anymore, and that they're willing to go and support them and give them international legitimacy. To tie in what I was just talking about, I think this also factors into what Iran is thinking about. Like, if President Trump can make a deal with Al-Qaeda and see them as trustworthy, then anything's possible. But there's another prophecy in Psalm 83 that speaks of Syria being part of this other Middle Eastern alliance that is allied with Europe and also attacks America and the other nations of biblical Israel. And this certainly is a stepping stone into Syria consolidating into this group. And then finally, yesterday, speaking of President Trump, he held the inaugural meeting of his much-touted Board of Peace yesterday, where, among other things, he revealed the names of the countries so far that have signed up to send peacekeepers to Gaza to help rebuild the Gaza Strip. The five countries are Albania, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Kosovo, and Morocco. All five are Muslim-majority countries, but they're also countries that Israel doesn't have any particular quarrels with. Four out of the five of those actually have relations with Israel, and quite cordial ones at that. The fifth one, Indonesia, doesn't have relations, but it's also on the other side of the world from the Middle East and has never fought a war with Israel. President Trump previously had lobbied to get Turkey and Qatar on the list, two countries that are very much not friends of Israel, and Prime Minister Netanyahu lobbied to get those scrapped. So it looks like at this point he was successful. We'll see if it remains that way. But either way, the fact that President Trump is moving forward with this Board of Peace, with this new plan for Gaza, shows we are going to see big changes in Gaza. And we have an article called "This Deal Will Not Bring Eternal Peace." When the ceasefire was originally announced, that no matter all the celebrations, no matter how much they move forward, we don't expect this to bring lasting peace to Gaza and the Holy Land, but rather more war down the road.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Well, the Strait of Hormuz, an important control point for world trade, and really an important test for America's prestige and reputation around the world. And our main story for Asia also revolves around an important seagate, an important point for controlling or at least securing maritime trade, and an important point for America's reputation and prestige around the world, and that is Taiwan. We'll hear the latest on China's approach to that island from our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. The big story that I wanted to talk about is that Chinese President Xi Jinping may have convinced U.S. President Donald Trump to cancel a major weapons sale to Taiwan. Taiwan, of course, is an independent nation. It's an exemplary democracy and a close and valuable partner to the United States. But Xi Jinping and the rest of the Chinese Communist Party don't view Taiwan as a real country. They see it as a breakaway province that it is their destiny to conquer. And Xi Jinping has vowed many times to use force to conquer Taiwan if that's necessary. And he's spent many years preparing a military that is capable of at least attempting a military takeover. So it's very logical that the Chinese would want to tilt any future conflict as far into their favor as they can just by leaving Taiwan vulnerable and as poorly armed as possible, because that'll make their future invasion plans that much easier. So what we've seen in recent days is Xi Jinping trying to use a trade deal to entice President Trump into basically abandoning Taiwan and ending arms sales to it. President Trump is planning a big visit to Beijing in April, and he and Xi Jinping spoke about all of this in a recent phone call, and Xi Jinping used that occasion to caution Trump against going through with this big arms sale, and it may have worked. The Wall Street Journal reported on this on Wednesday, quoting U.S. officials saying that President Trump and his advisors are now vacillating on the decision. They're not sure yet if they'll go through with this sale that would not only be crucial for Taiwan's ability to defend itself, but it would also be extremely lucrative to the United States to the tune of billions of dollars. So it would be a boon to Taiwan, it would be a windfall for the United States, and it would be good for global peace. But it would be bad for China. It would complicate China's illegal and expansionistic designs on Taiwan. So Xi Jinping is basically threatening to destroy the fragile peace that he and Trump have established in U.S.-China trade if this sale goes through. And as a result, President Trump is now wavering. Now, we do have to keep in mind that back in December, the Trump administration approved the largest ever arms sale to Taiwan. That was worth more than $11 billion. So that was a very positive step for Taiwan's security and for the deterrence of aggression. But Taiwan also needs this second package. So we can't know yet how this will play out. But even just the fact that President Trump is wavering and vacillating and viewing this as something transactional, like maybe Taiwan is just a bargaining chip whose freedom can be traded away. All of that is very sobering, not just for the Taiwanese to see, but for all of American allies around the world. And it's very encouraging for the aggressors of the world to see this. It shows a real absence of principles and will on the part of the United States. And the trumpet has warned for some 25 years now that America's lack of will and lack of resolve will be the main factor that will eventually enable the Chinese Communist Party to absorb Taiwan. It was back in 1998 that Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote about President Bill Clinton making a statement that essentially opposed Taiwanese independence. And Mr. Fleury wrote at that time a milestone article. And in that article, he called the Taiwanese people our freedom-loving friends. And he was adamant that America should support them. That was the right thing for America to do. There was no dispassionate realpolitik in his assessment. There was no, you know, pragmatic isolationism in the way Mr. Fleury discussed this. He called the Taiwanese our freedom-loving friends, and he was inescapably clear that America should militarily support democracies such as Taiwan, and that America should stand up to aggressors such as China. But Mr. Fleury said Clinton's statements meant Taiwan's freedom would not last. He said that they would eventually be conquered by China because of what he called, quote, a pitifully weak-willed America. And Mr. Fleury's assessment of this whole dynamic is based on biblical prophecy, particularly a passage in Leviticus 26, showing that modern America would lose its will to really use its power. And we have a free booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that covers the China-Taiwan conflict. It goes through everything that Mr. Fleury has said about this flashpoint. So for anyone who doesn't have a copy of Russia and China in Prophecy, I hope you'll cruise over to thetrumpet.com and order your free copy of it there so that you can understand the real context of this situation.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. I think we move right along and ask what else you have.
Yeah, first up, just one other quick story about China. Xi Jinping announced on Saturday that China will be lifting tariffs on 53 of Africa's 54 countries. So they already had essentially zero tariffs on 33 African countries. But now that number is up to 53. The only one omitted is the nation of Eswatini. And that's because Eswatini maintains diplomatic ties with Taiwan. So China, you know, wants to punish them for recognizing Taiwan's independence. But all the rest of Africa will have zero tariffs with China. And this comes at a time when many African states had already been tilting more toward China and further away from the United States, largely due to steep tariffs that the Trump administration introduced on African nations last year. So that shift will now accelerate, and it'll really cement China's standing as Africa's foremost economic and geopolitical partner. So a very significant move for Chinese power in Africa. And then I've got one final story here about South Korea. An update on former President Yoon Suk-yeol. He's the one who declared martial law back in 2024 when he was in power. And that plunged South Korea into just a terrible constitutional crisis. And then in the immediate aftermath of that, Mr. Yoon deployed South Korea's presidential security services twice to prevent police from arresting him, or to at least attempt to. So that was just a major political scandal, a five-alarm fire for South Korea. And this week, Mr. Yoon was sentenced to life in prison for what prosecutors called masterminding an insurrection. That was, I believe, the most serious of all the charges he faced. And most of the people in South Korea welcomed this verdict. Most of them welcomed it because they see Yoon's martial law declaration as an attempt to destroy their nation's democracy. But some of them actually thought that it didn't go far enough, and they stood outside the courthouse chanting, "Death sentence, death sentence." So South Korea does have the death penalty, and Mr. Yoon could have been given that sentence, but they've actually not executed anyone there for close to 30 years now. So that was always unlikely. But in either case, this story shows that democracy, you know, it is far better than other human systems of government. But as we see with this whole South Korean crisis, democracy is still fundamentally, fatally flawed, and it is not a system that can truly govern mankind.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, you could kind of say that Cuba is America's Taiwan, not in the sense that a previous ruling American regime has fled there and now set up as an independent state, but it performs a similar function as an important island, an important sea gate that can be used to control and potentially cut off the trade going to and from the mainland. America is also moving closer to getting control of Cuba. To get the latest from this, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that's a really apt comparison. I was actually doing a little bit of research a few days ago on just the geographic significance of Cuba. I guess I can opine on that a little bit before I get into the news story. But that's like back in the War of 1812, there was like, that when they teach that here in American schools anyway, they make a big deal about Andrew Jackson's seizure of the port of New Orleans, because the United States has the world's largest contiguous area of farmland connected by the world's longest navigable river system, and all empties out into New Orleans. So this was like a key of American power. But then extending that out a little bit, that port of New Orleans comes into the Gulf of Mexico. And then to get out of the Gulf of Mexico, you either have to go through the Yucatan Channel or the Straits of Florida, two narrow choke points on either end of Cuba. So half of U.S. trade, half of U.S. seaborne trade at least, goes through those two choke points into the Gulf of Mexico. Or what was previously called the Gulf of Mexico, what Trump's changed to the Gulf of America. So making Cuba just this really geopolitical pivot, one of our most important trade gates. And so obviously it's not just any other Latin American nation. There's many third world countries, many Latin American nations with dysfunctional governments, but Cuba... Cuba and Panama, between the Panama Canal and those two straits through Cuba, are our most important sea gates. And so the fact that Fidel Castro led a communist revolution there in the 1950s and let the Soviet Union into Cuba has been a thorn in America's side for decades. And America's sought regime change in Cuba for decades. The main reason that didn't happen during the Cold War was because of Soviet support. Then when the Berlin Wall collapsed and the Soviet Union fell, it really opened up a golden opportunity for regime change, which the Clinton administration in the 90s kind of fumbled. And then moving into 2000, Venezuela moved in as Cuba's main sponsor. And so now, with Donald Trump at least arresting the president of Venezuela, it's opened up another big opportunity for regime change in Cuba. What some economic analysts are even calling this Cuba's Berlin Wall moment, talking about like Cuba basically this chance that it detaches from the basically like Russo-Chinese system, communist system, it's been ingrained in for decades. And the reason is because Cuba is, like I said, it's a communist system, it's a poor nation, it doesn't generate much wealth, it's pretty much completely dependent on foreign oil. So now that Donald Trump has cut off the oil supply from Venezuela, then threatened to put tariffs on any nation that sends oil to Cuba, and is now using the U.S. Navy to keep oil ships away from Cuba. They just intercepted another boat from Colombia not long ago. It's having an effect. Bloomberg News did a satellite analysis of light and said basically, they said Cuba, they must be directing what oil they have to Havana, because Havana still is bright as ever at night. But most of the other major cities in Cuba, like they've got light curfews. You turn the lights off after a certain point in the night because they don't want to waste the oil, because more oil is not coming in. And some economic analysts are estimating that they might only have about 2 weeks of oil left. We don't know exactly how many reserves they have. But if Donald Trump keeps up this pressure, you've got a really good chance of, well, if you keep up enough pressure, just doing all an out regime change, or at least coming with some sort of deal. I think the latest news I saw this morning is we've got the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. He's actually doing back channel negotiations with Cuba right now. Interestingly enough, he's not talking with the president of Cuba, nor with any official members of the Cuban government, but he's talking with Raul Castro's grandson. Fidel Castro led the communist revolution in the 50s. He died in 2016. His younger brother Raul took over, led Cuba for about 5 years till he stepped down and let another younger party member become president. But his grandson, also Raul Castro, so they call him Rolita, I guess, or Little Raul. He's Raul's Castro's primary caretaker, and is also pretty influential in the business community in Cuba. It's kind of an ironic situation, is that they said the grandson Rolita, he's 41 years old. And he kind of represents Cuban business interest. So despite being the nephew and the grandson of the two guys who led the communist revolution, he's much more open to business investment in Cuba than the old guard. And because he's kind of the apple of his dad's eye, Raul, the Trump administration apparently views him as kind of the real decision maker going forward. They're not having anything to do with the official government officials in Cuba, but they're negotiating with Raul to see what does Cuba's new government look like, which means, according to some conversations Axios News has had with Cuban insiders. The Trump administration is dedicated to regime change in Cuba, and they want to keep up the oil embargo till they get that regime change. But similar to like they did in Venezuela, they don't want George Bush-style regime change, where you actually open up a lot of chaos as you're trying to form a new government. They want this a little more managed. So they're talking with the grandson of the two guys who led the Cuban Revolution to do kind of a cut some sort of deal. We still don't know what that deal is going to look like. But based on the fact of how Trump dealt with Venezuela, where he arrested Nicolas Maduro in a covert military operation and then let Nicolas Maduro's vice president remain the acting president of Venezuela, it may not be, unfortunately, a shocking regime change where Cuba becomes the shining light of Jeffersonian democracy across the Western Hemisphere. But more where you keep someone connected to the old guard, connected to the Castro dynasty, with some influence, but still open up business opportunities for Cuba. That's basically where the latest news analyst puts us, with Cuba under embargo, Marco Rubio negotiating with the grandson of the Castros, and looking at what sort of deal can the U.S. cut with Cuba in the days going forward.
We started talking about the royal family. I mean, this analogy will not make sense for many of our viewers, I guess, but it feels a bit like this Raoul Earl is Cuba's Richard Cromwell. You know, after Oliver Cromwell and got rid of the monarchy in Britain, and then his son just wasn't quite cut from the same cloth. Do a deal and you get the 1660 restoration and Charles II comes back. That seems like that's kind of the best case scenario that they're going for here, and that you could have a relatively benign bringing of Cuba back in from the fold without too much upheaval. And what do you see as the odds of them pulling that off?
I think very good. I actually looked, there's like a betting website that where people just give their opinions on the odds of what they think these are going to happen. And like Polymarket is giving about 55% odds that Cuba's current president is out by the end of the year. And I think that's very realistic as long as the Trump administration keeps up the embargo. Trump is somewhat notorious for changing his mind abruptly. So if he backs down, the odds might go down. But if he's committed to this, I think the U.S. has the power to do that this year. Really interesting, too, because back in 2015, Barack Obama partnered with the Vatican, Pope Francis at the time, to make a deal with Fidel Castro, who's now dead, the uncle, to basically open up some U.S. business opportunity in Cuba. And our editor-in-chief was very critical of that deal in a 2015 article titled The Deadly Dangerous Cuba Deal, highlighted Cuba's past attempts to working with the Soviet Union to undermine the United States, highlighting the fact that Fidel Castro was running a terrorist sponsoring state that was an enemy of America, and most importantly, highlighting Bible prophecies with Cuba aligning with the Holy Roman Empire to help besiege the United States, since that piece of land is right at the choke point where 50% of our maritime trade come in. He made a statement in that article that Cuba's only been communist for 50 years. It's been a little longer now because it's been a few years since that article. But they've been Catholic for 500. So he was definitely predicting this realignment of Cuba from Soviet Russia to the European Union, but still remaining as an enemy of the United States. And I feel like this deal, like we don't know exactly the terms of it yet, but this deal President Trump is trying to negotiate is going to be just as bad as Barack Obama's deal. Now, Barack Obama, he was definitely negotiating with Fidel himself. So it's really easy. It's really easy to criticize him for just being either really, really naive or actually having like America's worst interest at heart. Trump, you might be able to give a little more of a pass on the naivety angle because, like you said, with the Richard Cromwell analogy, like this isn't Oliver Cromwell, this is Richard Cromwell, who's a little different. So this isn't Fidel Castro and this isn't Raul Castro. This is a younger Castro who is legitimately less communist and more business-minded than his father and his uncle. So the Trump administration, they could say, is like, okay, this guy seems a lot more reasonable than his dad and his uncle were. However, that could be very prophetically significant in the fact that we are looking prophetically for a realignment from Cuba away from the Soviet Chinese system and more towards the European system. Still ending up as an enemy of America, because as our latest print edition of The Trumpet is about the Mercosur deal between the European Union and many South American nations. And Mr. Flory makes a strong point in the article that four prophecies in Deuteronomy 28 and Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 about a European-led Mart of Nations besieging the United States. Logistically, Latin America has to be part of that siege. The Latin American nations aren't necessarily called out by name in Deuteronomy 28, Isaiah 23, or Ezekiel 27. But since all our main maritime choke points are in Latin America, they have to be part of that siege. The Panama Canal has to be part of that siege. The Yucatan Channel has to be part of that siege. The Straits of Florida has to be part of that siege. And since Cuba is like the island that separates the Yucatan Channel from the States of Florida, Cuba has to be part of that siege. So there was a congressman this week who called this Cuba's Berlin Wall moment, saying that this could be the chance where communism collapses and Cuba reintegrates into Western society, which sounds really positive, but it's an interesting turn of phrase because Herbert Armstrong predicted or forecast the collapse of the Berlin Wall based on Bible prophecies in Daniel 22 about a revived Holy Roman Empire that has five nations in Western Europe and five nations in Eastern Europe. So the Warsaw Pact nations had to be liberated from the Soviet Union for that prophecy to be fulfilled. Mr. Armstrong predicted it, and it happened in 1989. Similarly, now we're not talking about Daniel 2, but we're talking about Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 and Deuteronomy 28. This prophecy is about this Holy Roman Empire besieging the United States. You need the Latin American and Caribbean nations to pull off that siege logistically. So just like East Germany had to break away from the Soviet Union and ally with the Holy Roman Empire, Cuba also has to be allied with this rising Holy Roman Empire. And so Trump's attempts to impose an embargo on Cuba and negotiate with Ralita to put a more pro-business regime in Cuba, it's like, okay, it's like, well, who, when Cuba breaks away from its alliance with like Russia and China and starts doing more pro-business things, who are they going to be doing business with? Well, primarily the Mercosur nations and the European Union. I mean, some business with the United States, probably in the short term, but I wouldn't be surprised. Venezuela, actually, which has close ties to Cuba, is already a suspended member of Mercosur. They're not one of the Mercosur nations that signed the deal because they were suspended due to Nicolas Maduro's election rigging and other things. But now that Nicolas Maduro is out, there's a really good chance that Venezuela is going to be unsuspended from Mercosur. And I think there's a decent chance that, given the close ties between Cuba and Venezuela, Cuba may also end up in Mercosur within the next few years.
Well, thank you for that analysis. Andrew, anything else from the English-speaking world that's worth knowing about?
Yeah, another big story, breaking news story that I'm actually working on for our morning brief. Our morning brief's probably going to go out a little late today because this just happened. But the Supreme Court struck down Donald Trump's tariffs this morning. Or in particularly, they didn't strike down all his tariffs. They struck down his use of the 1977 Emergency Powers Act to impose tariffs on about 150 nations. That act says that in the case of a national emergency, the president can use tariffs as a foreign policy tool. President Trump said that the trade deficit itself was an emergency. Therefore, he was basically imposing tariffs on everyone all around the world. Finally, this morning, the Supreme Court said that, like, well, that's an inappropriate use of the Emergency Powers Act. You can't use it that way. The $175 million in tariffs you already collected under that statute may have to be refunded. And if you want to continue imposing tariffs, you're going to have to find another law other than the Emergency Powers Act. And there are some other laws. It's going to be harder for the Donald Trump administration to continue imposing tariffs without the act. There are ways around it. A fairly controversial court ruling in that it actually divided the conservative ring. The majority opinion was authored by Chief Justice John Roberts. The three liberals sided with him because it was against Trump. And then two of the conservatives, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, also sided with him, with the other three conservatives, Brett Kavanaugh, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas, ruling that Donald Trump actually does has the right. So one of the few court decisions that was so controversial that even the conservatives on the court split down the middle. And so we'll see what happens going forward. This doesn't mean that Donald Trump is never going to impose a tariff on another nation again. It is going to be considerably harder for him to do so.
Yeah, I think I don't want to get into too much to this because maybe we can discuss it more next week. But I think you're absolutely right. There's this perception in Europe that if the courts are struck down, they're free. They don't have to worry about tariffs. This is all of their problems over. And that is not true. They've struck down. Like, he has a host of other avenues and other ways of looking at producing tariffs. And even the dollar got weaker since that announcement, which acts as kind of an invisible tariff anyway. So the effect of that on U.S. imports, we'll have to see how significant that is. But thank you for bringing us that. Sorry.
Okay. I think his threat to impose tariffs on countries that send oil to Cuba will still stand, because since Cuba is actually on the State Department's list of terrorist sponsoring states, your case that you're doing this because of a national security threat is quite strong, as opposed to unilaterally imposing a 10% tariff on every nation on Earth because the trade deficit is a national security threat. That's the type of thing the Supreme Court's zooming in on. And two other stories, one also involving more trade-related news, is that it finally was confirmed this week. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney confirmed that he is indeed spearheading negotiations between the European Union and the CPTPP. That's a group of 12 nations with coastlines on the Pacific, to form a trade zone between them that will help isolate the United States. So together, those two trade unions comprise 1.5 billion people and about a third of global trade. So just another indication of the United States being more isolated from the rest of the world as the European Union forms trade agreements. This one's interesting in that Canada, in Ezekiel 4 and Ezekiel 5, is actually prophesied to be one of the Anglo-Saxon nations that are economically besieged by the European Union. So Carney's strategy to side with Europe against the United States will likely end up backfiring on him, but still a significant development in the formation of the Smart of Nations against the United States, and a significant development in basically just increasing division between peoples on the North American continent. There was a political poll out this week that I can do as my last Anglo-American news story about basically half of Canadians now rank the United States under Donald Trump as a greater threat to world peace than Russia under Vladimir Putin. So just intense levels of anti-Americanism growing in Canada. Also highlighted by Carney's attempts to align Canada with the European Union and Asian nations against the United States. Even we know that prophetically, when these prophecies are ultimately fulfilled about a Euro-Asian trade siege against Ephraim and Manasseh, it will be both the U.S. and Canada who end up as victims of that prophesied siege.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. Thank you to all of our panelists today and to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. Once again, I'll mention that book, The New Throne of David, not one that we've mentioned on this show for quite a while. If you want to learn more about particularly that royal family story that we were talking about at the start, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to send that to you. And all of the other pieces of material that we mentioned, the King of the South, United States and Britain in prophecy, Russia and China in prophecy, all of that is available on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read it online and get your own free print copy to study and prove alongside your Bible. Well, thank you so much for joining us. If you have any questions, any comments, any difficulty in trying to get to any of those resources, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back probably with a look at our latest Trumpet print magazine next week. Until then, keep watching your world.